Joshua's good looks. I took a thorough accounting of Darren. He was single, in school, and gainfully employed. He had come through for me out of the blue, and he was still there. If I wanted to stop getting my heart broken, it wasn't enough to stop being self-absorbed. I needed to stop chasing after guys as self-absorbed as I was. I leaned in so that my mouth was in kissing range. "Maybe we'd both get some sleep if you got in bed with me," I said. If he'd pulled the taking advantage number again, I don't think I could have forgiven him. But lo and behold, he kissed me. Of course, we didn't go to sleep until dawn. I had finally drifted off with Darren's arm around me when I heard the front door open. I thought about getting up to see what Wavy was doing, but I was naked and comfortable, so I stayed in bed. Then there was a thumping sound, and the front door opened and closed. A few minutes later, the door opened, and there was more thumping. I got dressed and went out to the living room, where a pile of large library books was forming next to the coffee table. I picked up a blue leather-bound volume marked State Penal Code 1981 to Present, Volume 24. On the spine was a sticker that said, "Law Ref, Non-Circ." While I was trying to decide what it meant, Wavy came through the door carrying more books, stacked up almost to her chin. She dropped them next to the other books and went down the hallway to her bedroom. "Are these reference books from the law library?" I yelled. "You can't check these out, can you?" "The janitor smokes." "You went to the law library, snuck past the janitor on his smoke break and stole books?" I could almost hear her shrug. She came back with a spiral notebook and a pen, picked up the top book and hauled it to the kitchen table. From there, it looked like any other homework assignment. She ran her finger down the index, thumbed into the book, and started reading. Every once in a while, she would stop and copy something into her notebook. I left her to it and went back to bed. When Darren and I finally got up, she was still working. It was the kitchen table, after all, so I cooked brunch around her. I was worried it would be awkward, but she said, "Hi," to Darren and shifted some of the books so there was a place to eat. Honestly, I was the only one who seemed uneasy, but that's because I was trying to figure out what was going on with Wavy. She'd gone from destroyed to driven overnight. But driven by what? She hadn't put her ring back on, and there was a gap of paler skin on her hand where it usually was. When she took a bathroom break, I reached across the table and grabbed her notebook. "No contact order" was the header on the first page. Below that was a series of bullet points. Expiration of civil orders. Automatic NCO in cases of DV. Imposed by parole board. Imposed by parole agency. Imposed by sentencing judge. The header on the next page was "Process for removing NCO imposed by parole board." The pages after that had headers for different scenarios, waiting for Wavy's notes. 13. Wavy. June 1990. For a few days afterwards, I could press my fingers up into myself and find the raw spot Kellen had left. The swelling in my wrist went down after a few days and left the bruise in the shape of his fingers. And that faded, too. I put the ring away in the velvet box the lady in the jewelry store had given me, because I couldn't wear it anymore. Kellen had made me keep the ring, but he hadn't put it back on my finger. That meant it wasn't my wedding ring. When I pressed it to my mouth, it was just a rock. The difference between a meteor falling through the atmosphere and a meteorite lying in the dirt. I didn't regret kicking my electric typewriter down the stairs. Aunt Brenda had given it to me for my high school graduation, and whether she intended it or not, gifts take up space in your heart. I needed that space now. I finished my Spanish essay on a computer on campus. For the letters I needed to write, I had the manual Underwood that Grandma taught me to type on. It was army green and weighed almost 13 pounds. It worked fine, and Grandma didn't take up any more room in my heart than a floor takes up space in a house. When Renee wasn't complaining about the sound of me typing, she was hovering anxiously. I don't know what she thought I would do if she left me alone too long. Get high on correction fluid? Or maybe she thought I would do what I did. Write a letter a day to Kellen's parole officer until his supervisor wrote me back.
Dear Miss Quinn, I apologize for the delay in responding to your letters. To answer your questions, the conditions of Jesse Joe Barfoot's parole were not set by this office. Therefore, we are unable to alter the no-contact order. The conditions of his parole were set by the sentencing judge. To have them changed, you would need to file a formal appeal in the district court where he was sentenced. Sincerely, James Teeter.
What happens now? Renee said. Formal appeal in district court. I opened my accordion file folder, put the letter in one slot, and pulled out a form J-319-7. Modification to orders of protection and no contact. I put it in the old Underwood and rolled it up.
Wow, there's a form for that? Renee said.
I'd requested the form even before I knew I would need it, just like I'd requested copies of Kellen's final judgment from the district court. I took those out, too, to be sure I got everything correct on the form. It made me sick to see him listed there by the name he never wanted, Jesse Joe Barfoot, Jr. They'd taken away his identity, pressed him back into his father's mold. Kellen wasn't the only one who had his identity stripped away in those records. Every place I appeared, I was the minor victim, identified only as WLQ. To protect me, of course, even if I didn't want to be protected. That was what I put in the very small space provided on the form for me to justify my request to have the no-contact order rescinded. I do not wish to be protected by the court's order, as the defendant presents no danger to me.
Have you considered becoming a lawyer? Renee said while I typed.
Never. I thought of all the lawyers who'd passed through my life, and I didn't envy any of them, the part they'd played. I drove up to Garinger by myself to file the form and pay the $50 filing fee. After that, I waited. Just like I'd been waiting for years. Renee talked about how electronic mail was going to be the next big thing, but the dented mailbox in the front hall of our apartment building was still my god. Every day I prayed that it would deliver up a letter from Donald, or from someone who knew where he was. I prayed for it to bring me an answer from the district court. I wondered if that was what it was like for Kellen, after he'd written Liam's phone number on my arm. When he was sitting alone and bleeding, waiting for me to come back. Had it seemed like a month to him? Had it seemed longer? Had it seemed hopeless? 14. Kellen. July 1990. That first week I slept at the same dive hotel where I'd stayed when Beth's grandkids came to visit. Most of June, when the weather was good, I stayed at a campground in a tent I picked up from an army surplus store. Reminded me of sleeping out in the meadow with Wavy. And it was that memory as much as the summer heat that made me give it up. After a couple more nights in a motel, I moved in with Craig, one of the guys at the shop. Him and his ex-wife was expecting a baby, though, and she didn't like me being there when he was out. By the middle of August, I was back to another crappy motel and working as many hours as I could, so I wouldn't have to be at the motel except to sleep. I had my head up under the hood of a Toyota when somebody said, "Jesse," behind me. There was Beth, with her hair dyed this new dark color of red, holding my baseball bat. Wouldn't have surprised me if she'd swung it at me, but she said, "You forgot this, thought you might want it, and your winter coat." The employee lounge was just a closet with lockers and chairs, but it was kind of private, so I took her in there. I stuck the bat and coat in my locker and counted $300 out of my wallet. "Thanks for bringing my stuff. This here's for May's rent and electric," I said.
"You were only there for a week."
"Yeah, well, I still owe you the rent." She took the money and put it in her purse. Then she just looked at me, so I knew she was waiting for me to say something. "Look, I'm sorry about what happened. I know that was a lousy thing to do to you. If I'd been thinking, is it over?
Are you still breaking your parole?
Beth said. No, I haven't seen her again.
If it's over, you could come back. I won't put up with you breaking your parole, but if you promise it's over, we could try again.
I guess I didn't answer soon enough because she stood up and put her purse over her shoulder.
Jesus Christ. I can't believe I came here thinking you might be interested in a second chance.
I can't come back, because I can't promise anything. If Wavy showed up tomorrow, I'd do it all over again. I loved her the first time I saw her, and I still do.
Love at first sight, huh? Beth snorted. How old was she?
8.
That's creepy.
She said a bunch of other shitty things, too. You should have stayed in prison if that's how you're going to live, and nothing like flushing the rest of your life down the toilet over some young girl you're never going to be with. Like I didn't wish I was dead most of the time. Like I hadn't spent some time thinking about where I could buy a gun and solve it. Almost as much time as I'd spent thinking about breaking my parole and seeing Wavy. After Beth got that out of her system, she asked me to move back in with her. I said yes, but only as roommates. She needed help with the rent, and I needed some place to stay that wasn't going to get me in trouble with my parole officer. It would have been nicer to live alone, but at least now Beth couldn't lay there at night and talk me half to death when I wanted some quiet. She didn't have any business complaining about my deodorant or my haircut or my tattoos. She still did, but I didn't have to pay attention. The real difference was that Beth couldn't put her hand on my dick and say, "Turn off the TV and let's go in the bedroom," whether I wanted to or not. I don't think I could have stomached that. Not when I had Wavy burned in my brain. Some nights when I came home from work and walked into the kitchen, all I could think of was the way she'd stood on the chair and stripped down to her boots, how she'd run her hands over me. No woman had ever looked at me the way she did, or touched me that way. Like she wanted me. Like I was worth wanting. Most times all I could think of was how she'd come there and given herself to me. I didn't even have the decency to tell her we couldn't be together until after. Just desperate to be with her. I was still the same guy who let her give me a hand job when she was all of 13.
15. Renee. August 1990.
It got to where Wavy wouldn't even let me check the mailbox. If I went to get the mail, she practically tackled me when I came back and yanked it out of my hands. Good thing I'm not expecting any love letters, I said while she rifled through the flyers and bills.
You don't need love letters. She thumped her hand on the kitchen table half a dozen times to mimic the sound of my headboard knocking against my bedroom wall, but I knew she didn't begrudge me the fun I was having with Darren. 3 weeks later, Wavy's answer came. Or rather, an answer. It was a copy of the form she submitted, with the bottom half filled out by hand. The box next to, "This matter was not set for hearing," had been checked. Below that, where the form said, "After review of the file and evidence, the court orders that the above-referenced protection or no-contact order entered on September 9, 1983, shall be modified as follows." Someone had written, "No modification. Order remains in force." That same person had signed the form. Judge C.J. Maber.
The judge said no? He said no? What a fucking asshole!
I was so pissed off. I couldn't imagine how angry Wavy must have been. It wouldn't have surprised me if she had torn the form up or thrown her typewriter down the stairs. But she didn't. She spent maybe a minute glaring at the form and grinding her teeth. Then she sat down, stuck a piece of paper in the typewriter and started tapping, "Dear Judge Maber." Contrary to Wavy's usual habits, it was short and polite, just a request to meet with the judge. When she didn't get an answer, though, the letters multiplied exponentially. The sheer quantity of them started to worry me, because at what point did it become harassment to send a letter a day to a judge? At least if the cops showed up. Wavy had returned all the illicitly borrowed law books to the library. I wasn't home when the letter came, but I knew something big had happened by the way Wavy was tearing around the apartment when I got home from my first class of the semester.
She had half the clothes in her closet strewn out on the couch, and as soon as I walked in, she put the letter in my hand. It wasn't even from the judge. It was from his clerk, and it just said, "Judge Maber is available to meet with you on Wednesday, August 15th at 8 a.m. The judge's court session begins at 9 a.m., so please be prompt." We had less than 36 hours to get Wavy ready for her meeting with the judge, and the girl owned a closet full of plain Jane smocks, 4 pairs of shoes, 2 pairs of boots, shower shoes, and a pair of tennis shoes for her phys ed requirement that I know for a fact she bought in the children's department. If I was going to help Wavy look like an adult, we had to start from scratch. I don't know if Wavy slept that night, but the next morning we drove into the city early enough to be there when the stores opened. Within an hour, we had to give up on a business suit. They didn't make them in Wavy's size. We settled on a school uniform skirt in navy wool, but there was nothing else in the girls' section at Macy's that didn't look like it was for little girls. The cashier there suggested what she called a luxury ladies' store that carried small sizes, the sort of chichi place my mother loved to shop at. Wavy had turned 21 in July, so she could write checks off her trust without getting permission from anyone. Otherwise, I could imagine her aunt's response to Wavy dropping almost $400 on a silk blouse and an extra small petite and a pair of Italian snakeskin slingback pumps in a size 4.5. My mother once described Wavy as 2 steps away from the trailer park, so I couldn't wait to tell her they had the same taste in dress shoes. Back at the apartment, Wavy washed the styling gel out of her hair and I gave her waves instead of spikes. I showed her how to shave her legs even though she didn't need it. You couldn't even see the hairs on her legs. "On principle," she said, "if adults shaved their legs, Wavy would shave hers." Then we took the only trial run we were going to get. Skirt, blouse, bra, pantyhose, and shoes. I taught her how to walk in the heels, and once she could manage the stairs and a trip around the block, I officially declared her a grown-up. In the dark hours of Wednesday morning, we made 3 attempts at her makeup. The first time she was nervous about me touching her face. The second failure was a product of how disturbing Wavy looked in full makeup, like a child prostitute. In the end, we went minimalist. Lipstick, eyeshadow. By the time she left for Garinger, the sun was coming up, and Wavy looked, if not exactly like an adult, then adult-like. 16. Judge C.J. Maber. I remembered the case, although it never went to trial. It didn't hurt that I'd had Barfoot in my courtroom before on 2 separate assault charges. He left an impression. A giant of a man with a vicious temper, who still managed to look sheepish in court. I didn't bother to pull the file before I declined to rescind the no-contact order. When the letters started coming, I looked at the file to refresh my memory. I still wasn't inclined to meet with Miss Quinn, but I knew from long experience that some people cannot be put off. Some of them will persist until I agree to meet with them. Miss Quinn arrived at my chambers right on time, and I was glad to see she was a serious young woman. I had no patience with the weepers and the screamers. That kind of woman makes me ashamed of my own sex. Miss Quinn was poised and well-dressed, but I couldn't have guessed her age if I hadn't already known it. Because Barfoot pled out, I'd never laid eyes on the girl, never seen how small and delicate she was. Honestly, if I had, I would have sentenced Barfoot to more than 10 years. She took the chair I pointed her to and set down a briefcase, which invariably held a photo album, containing pictures meant to tug at my heartstrings. "Miss Quinn, may I call you Wavana?"
"Wavy," she said.
"Wavy, then. May I ask you some questions? I like to get at the things it didn't occur to them to tell me. Most of all, I like to let them know that they were important to me. To let them know they had value that wasn't connected to the man they loved. Some of them got impatient, wanting to get to the real matter, but for many of them, I was possibly the first person in authority who had ever really expressed interest in them.
Wavy was neither impatient nor starved for attention. I asked her about whether she was in school or employed. Both.
Astrophysics, she said when I asked what she was studying.
A smart girl, then. I know you've come here today to try to convince me to rescind the no-contact order I put in place at Mr. Barfoot's sentencing. But your presence here is proof to me that it was the right thing then, and is still the right thing.
It isn't fair.
She didn't quite interrupt me, but she snuck in those three words while I was taking a breath.
Keeping him away from me was supposed to protect me. But I don't want to be protected. I love him. And I'm being punished, even though I didn't do anything wrong.
I was struck silent for a moment, not by her words, which I'd heard hundreds of times from hundreds of other women, but by the quality of her voice. Husky and incredibly quiet, but not shy. I could have cut her off at any moment, because that little speech took her half a dozen breaths. She was quiet for a moment, uncrossing her legs and reaching for her briefcase. As I'd known she would, she sprang her heartbreaking photo album on me. Or at any rate, her heartbreaking photo. It was a picture of Mr. Barfoot, Wavy, and a little blonde boy of 5 or 6 years. All three were smiling. Mr. Barfoot had taken the picture, holding the camera out in front of them. They looked happy, of course. Familial. That was the point of those pictures.
This is my family. My little brother, Donald. Kellen. Not Barfoot. My real family. You can help put it back together, Wavy said.
I somehow expected more from a girl as bright as you obviously are.
Her eyes narrowed, so that I could see I hadn't rattled her so much as I had angered her.
I cannot even begin to tell you how many women I see like you, Wavy. Women who have fallen in love and think that gives a man the right to do anything to them. Most of them are victims of domestic violence, which I realize was not the case for you. What Mr. Barfoot did to you, however, was equally as harmful, if not more so. These women come to me, sometimes after waiting for years for their husbands, boyfriends, fiancés, the fathers of their children to get out of prison. They come to me and beg me to reunite them with this man they love, this man who has slapped them and punched them and kicked them and sometimes raped them. They blame his terrible childhood, or the drugs, or the alcohol, or another woman, or the war. They come to me with a photo album just as you have to show me pictures of happier times, and they ask me to make their family whole again. I am telling you this because I want you to understand how many times I see this. Because I think you're smart enough to see the rationale behind my decision, to see that I did the right thing by protecting you, and not just when you were a child, but by protecting you from making a mistake now.
Were you there when my father did this?
She laid her finger to her bottom lip, where she had an old white scar. Of course, no. I wasn't there to protect you from any injuries your father might have inflicted on you. That doesn't negate Kellen protected me, she said. They always had a story about some kind of generous thing he'd done for them. Look at you. You're in your senior year of college, with the opportunity for a good, successful life ahead of you. If you return to Mr. Barfoot, who not only was willing to exploit you as a child, but who is a high school dropout with a criminal record full of assaults, what do you think will become of that opportunity?
He took me to school. For 6 years. Paid my school fees. Dropped me off. Picked me up. 6 years. No one else cared. His money pays my tuition now. He gave me this opportunity, she said.
Miss Quinn, I need to get ready for court. I truly wish you the best, even for Mr. Barfoot. But you would both be better served by focusing on your respective futures, rather than dwelling on the past.
Getting them to leave was always the hardest part. They didn't want to give up. They wanted to fight. Maybe they thought that was what I wanted to see, proof of how much they loved this man who had hurt them.
Wavy, however, stood and picked up her briefcase. As she was about to retrieve the photo she'd laid on my desk, she hesitated.
"Your family?" she said. Before I could stop her, she reached across my desk and picked up the framed picture that I always kept facing myself. It was an old photo, from when my children were small, and my husband and I were both thinner and less gray.
"Yes."
She shifted her gaze from the photo to me. I was discomfited by the intensity of that look, and I saw it for what it was. An accusation.
"Your family is real, but mine isn't. Real people with real feelings, but my family isn't."
She ran out of air and took a gulp.
"Real to you? You think I'm a character? A story? Those women you talk about? Not real people to you. Stupid women. Stupid photo albums. But you? You're smart. You make smarter choices. For us."
She was almost panting, and seeing the way the picture trembled in her hand, I rolled my chair back from the desk. Although there had been a few close calls, I'd never actually had a physical altercation with anyone. I always kept the door open so that if things got heated, the bailiffs could hear. But Wavy's anger was so hushed, no one had noticed.
"Please, don't upset yourself. I really do have to go to court."
I stood up and walked around the desk. Although she was still holding my family photo, she didn't try to stop me. So I poked my head out into the hallway and gestured for the bailiff.
"Edward, would you please escort Miss Quinn out?"
She put the picture frame down and went with Edward. But as she walked away, she raised her voice.
"I'm real. I'm as real as you are. My family is real like your family," she said.
17. Wavy. I needed to get back to Norman in time for my afternoon class, but when I passed the exit for the old quarry where we raced the Barracuda, the rotation of the earth seemed to slow. The sun hovered at a standstill in the sky while I turned the car around and drove back through Geringer. I used to think of it as a big city, but now it was gone in a blink, and I was on the road to Powell. Driving down Main Street, I felt like I was in a ghost story, but I didn't know who was the ghost, me or all of Powell County. Downtown wasn't much different than I remembered. Maybe a few more storefronts were empty, but the hardware store had the same tools in the window, and the Shop and Save had hail damage to their front sign. Off Main Street, Kutchin's small engine had a yellowed sheet of notebook paper taped in the window. "Closed till further notice," it said in Mr. Kutchin's handwriting. Kellen's house was occupied, but run down. Nobody had painted it since we did, and the carport looked like it was about to fall down. Two dogs chained up in the front yard barked at me as I walked past. On the drive out to the meadow, I turned off the air conditioning and opened the windows. The heat and the dust rolled into the car, but the wind in my face was the closest I could get to riding on a motorcycle. There was a new double-wide parked where Sandy's trailer used to be, but I think the people living there were actually farming, because there were tractors parked by the barns. Cattle grazed in the meadow and they turned their heads and watched me with soft brown eyes as I drove past. The driveway to the farmhouse was so washed out, I had to park on the road and walk up, getting gravel in my fancy shoes. The honeysuckle vines had crawled up over the front porch and collapsed the trellis below the attic window. The screen door flapped in the breeze and the kitchen door stood partway open. When I lived there, we'd never had a key to the kitchen door, so the police must have simply pulled the door closed. Anyone who wanted to walk in could, including me. I hadn't been inside the house since Donald and I left that July to go visit Aunt Brenda. She never allowed us to come back.
The kitchen floor was stained brown from Val's blood and grayed over with the dust of strangers walking through. Vandals must have used the table and chairs to build fires in the front room's fireplace. They'd left behind beer bottles and spray-painted the dining room walls. Upstairs in my room, Aunt Brenda had only taken the quilt Grandma made. She took that to Tulsa and packed it away because it was an heirloom, too valuable to use. She'd left the little black-and-white TV and someone had broken out its screen. I could see from the dirty sleeping bag and the condom wrappers that strangers had used the bed where Kellen and I spent so many nights lying next to each other. I came back down to the kitchen and stood at the spot where Val had died, just a few feet away from where Kellen kissed me for the first time. I pulled the kitchen door closed as I went out, and the porch floor creaked as I crossed to the steps. Walking back to my car, I followed the overgrown path to the limestone steps, where Kellen had sat after his wreck. I'd been wrong about the Earth's rotation slowing. It went on as steadily as always, and the afternoon was long gone. To the west, Venus and Jupiter held court with the setting sun. A few days before, the Magellan spacecraft had reached Venus and started sending back pictures. Below the horizon lay Orion, resting until autumn when he would rise over the meadow with only the cows to see him. I thought then of Voyager 1 and 2 so far away. They were launched the same year I met Kellen, and now they had reached the end of our solar system. Although their programs were being powered down one by one, they traveled on. NASA said that in another 25 years they would exit our heliosphere and cross into interstellar space. In another 300,000 years, Voyager 2 might reach as far as the star Sirius. But it would never come home. That was how I felt as I walked down the driveway to my car. I was moving forward into space, but I would never come home again. Hours later, walking up the stairs to the apartment, I still felt like a satellite, untethered from gravity. Above me, Renee opened our apartment door.
"Wavy! Oh my God, where have you been?"
she shouted. When I reached her, she was a star, pulling me into her orbit.
"Judge Maber called. She said, 'Tell Miss Quinn that she was right. She is just as real as I am.'"
18. Kellen. September 1990. Beth could nag at me all she wanted about my cholesterol, but I went back to eating bacon and eggs and pancakes with real butter like Wavy used to cook. That's what I had for breakfast before my weekly meeting with my parole officer. Beth was at the counter packing her lunch while I ate, but she kept looking over her shoulder at me. Made me real self-conscious. "What?" I said. "Did you see the mail yesterday?" she said. "No." I figured somebody had stuck another flyer about me in the mailbox. People still did that, even though I was careful. I never talked to kids, not for nothing. Far as I was concerned, kids didn't exist. Which left me feeling like shit any time I saw some kid's busted down bike. I could have fixed it, but people might have thought the wrong thing. Beth pitched a letter on the table in front of me. The only mail I ever got was official stuff from the Department of Corrections, only this one wasn't. It'd been years since I got a letter in that handwriting, but I knew it from back when Wavy used to send me Christmas cards from her aunt's house. "I won't tell you again," Beth said. "If you break your parole, you can't live here." She went back to fixing her lunch and I tried to finish my breakfast, but that letter had thrown me for a loop. First, it meant Wavy knew I was living with Beth again. All she had to do was call the Department of Corrections and they'd give her my current address off the sex offender registry. I had to figure she thought the worst of me, because what else was she going to think? I'd made her keep the ring and went back to living with Beth, like the ring didn't mean a thing to me. Second, it meant Wavy had something to say to me. But what?
"Are you going to open it or read it through the envelope?" Beth said.
It was the same voice she used to say all the mean things she said when I came back. "Neither. Just throw it away,"
That's what you were going to do anyway, isn't it? She didn't hardly wait for me to get the words out of my mouth before she picked it up and tossed it in the trash can. After that, I couldn't get the food down my throat, and it was time to go. When I went to scrape my plate off into the trash, there was the letter staring up at me. I dumped what was left of my breakfast in on top of it. My parole officer was a good guy, but busy, so I was usually in and out in under 10 minutes. It started out like all the other meetings. How are you doing? How's work? Having any troubles? Then all of a sudden he said, Have you been in contact with Wivanna Quinn? No, hell no. First outright lie I ever told him. I broke out in a cold sweat and I couldn't figure out which made me seem guiltier, looking him in the eye or looking away. I gave him a good long stare and said, No way. Why would you think that? Just curious, he said. Just curious, my ass. I thought about that letter and about how Beth was still pissed off at me. Made me wonder if she hadn't called him. He didn't push me on the subject, and 2 minutes later I was out of there. I should have gone to work, but I didn't. I drove home, went into the apartment, and first thing, yanked the lid off the trash can. Inside was a new trash bag. It was my job to take the trash out, but Beth had done it, just so she could throw Wavy's letter away. That's how I ended up in the garbage dumpster, sifting through bags of trash. The day was warming up and that dumpster stank like hell. I must have opened a dozen bags before I found Wavy's letter, sticky with syrup. I crawled out of the dumpster and sat on the curb next to it. My stomach was right up under my throat when I opened the envelope.
Dear Kellen, I thought you would come to me after you got the letter from the court, but you didn't. I can imagine 1,000 reasons you wouldn't come, and only one reason you would, but I hoped that reason would be enough. I won't bother you again. I'm only writing because I have something I need to return to you. Because of its size, it would be best if you could come get it. Will you meet me at my aunt's house over Labor Day weekend, Sunday at 4? If you prefer not to see me, you can come after 5 p.m. I'll be gone by then. See you soon. Love, Wavy.
I never got any letter from the court, but there'd been a few weeks when I was moving around so much I didn't know where I was going to sleep, let alone where to tell my parole officer I was living. Then again, maybe it came and Beth threw it away. Not knowing what was in that missing letter scared the hell out of me, because I couldn't afford to go getting my hopes up. Whatever was in it, I had two choices. I either had to throw the letter back in the dumpster and go to work, or I had to go upstairs and pack my stuff. There wasn't no middle ground.
19. Amy. I hadn't planned to go home for Labor Day until Mom told me Wavy was coming. That's what her letter said, the first one I've had from her in months, Mom said. Wavy hadn't written to me since May either, and now that she was 21, I'd started to wonder if we would ever see her again. Hearing that she intended to visit was a relief, until I considered that she might be planning a showdown with my mother. The question was whether I wanted to witness it. Mom threw the same Labor Day party every year, a Sunday lunch of daiquiris and burgers on the back patio with a few of her book club friends. Wavy didn't show for lunch, and by 4 o'clock everyone else had gone home. Mom and I were in the living room when Wavy walked in the front door, carrying a couple of manila envelopes. She looked weary. "You're too late for lunch, but I'm glad you came," Mom said. I didn't know what to say. Sorry I was an unwitting accomplice to my mother's betrayal. "Did you come down by yourself, or did you bring Renee?" I was hoping for somebody else to be a buffer between Wavy and Mom. "Meeting her boyfriend's parents," Wavy said. "Oh, so she's getting serious with a new boyfriend," Mom said. We managed small talk for 20 or 30 minutes, but just as I started to relax, the doorbell rang. Wavy glanced at her watch, and for a few seconds weariness transformed into grief. Then she stood up and went to answer the door. "What in the world?" Mom said it like she expected a pleasant surprise. When she and I got to the door, Wavy was signing something on a clipboard held by a skinny guy in a baseball cap. Behind him,
A flatbed truck stood parked at the curb.
"Did you have car trouble?" I said.
"Or did you finally decide to sell that old motorcycle?" Mom's look of triumph was wasted on Wavy, who was already backtracking through the house to open the garage door. The motorcycle stood in the corner with a bedsheet thrown over it to keep off the dust, in between visits from the mechanic. As Wavy pulled the sheet away, the envelope slipped out from under her arm. I bent to pick them up and found one addressed to my mother and one addressed to Kellen. His contained something small and square. A ring box. I held them out to her, but she had her hands over her eyes.
"You son of a bitch!" my mother screamed from the front yard. "You just broke the conditions of your parole. I'll see you back in jail."
Wavy grabbed the envelopes out of my hand and we both ran out of the garage. Kellen stood out in the street next to an old dented pickup truck. He looked terrified, and who could blame him with my mother shouting like that? I ran toward Mom, and I expected Wavy to go to Kellen, but she came after me. We caught up with Mom on the front porch as she was opening the storm door, probably going inside to call the police. Wavy reached past her and slammed the door closed.
"You lied to the parole board, and you lied to me," Wavy said through clenched teeth. She looked both angry and like she might cry.
"I was only trying—"
Before Mom could explain herself, Wavy flattened one of the manila envelopes against Mom's chest with her open palm. "This is from the judge, to change Kellen's parole." Kellen squinted up at the porch, at the three of us watching him. It dawned on me that he didn't know why he was there. He was risking going back to jail on nothing more than Wavy's word. He didn't know it was the happiest day of his life. I understood then why the reunion was happening there instead of someplace else. Not to throw it in my mother's face, but because Mom's house was the place where Wavy had drawn a line. The day she stood in our driveway and screamed, "Mine!" She wasn't talking about the motorcycle. As Mom opened the manila envelope, Wavy started down the sidewalk. Kellen crossed the street and stepped up on our curb. I expected a joyful, over-the-top romantic movie reunion. But they walked toward each slowly. They met about halfway, and she handed him the other envelope. He felt the bottom of it where the ring box was and shook his head. It was easy to make out the word no, but I don't know what else he said. When Wavy spoke, I could guess what she was telling him. His answer made Wavy throw her head back and laugh. Kellen opened the envelope and stuck his hand in. He pulled out the ring box just as Wavy jumped up and threw her arms around his neck. The force of it staggered him back half a step, but when they kissed each other, it was a romantic movie. The sequel to that goodbye in Kellen's shop. I think they would have gone on kissing for a long time, but Mom stepped off the porch and shouted,
"Get off my property, you bastard, or I'll have you arrested for trespassing!"
Blushing and frowning, Kellen lowered Wavy to her feet. She took his hand and led him toward the driveway.
"If he steps foot on my property, I'll call the police."
Mom knew Wavy couldn't move the motorcycle by herself, and the tow truck driver seemed to take the trespassing remarks to heart. He stood by the cab of his truck watching us warily. "I'll help you," I said. Together, Wavy and I pushed the bike down the driveway. A few times I thought we were going to drop it, but we made it to the curb, ignoring my mother's glared threat. Kellen took it from us and rolled it into the street with a stunned look on his face.
"I wonder if it'll even start," he said as he swung his leg over the bike.
I just knew it would start the first time, and it did. When he twisted the throttle, the whole street echoed with the engine. Kellen grinned at Wavy, and then he seemed to remember something. He stood up and pulled the ring box out of his pocket. The ring wouldn't go up over her middle knuckle until he ducked his head and licked her finger. He laughed as he slid the ring up.
"We gotta get that resized," he said.
He raised her hand to his mouth again and kissed the ring. I'd taken a few steps back, feeling awkward about intruding on them, but Kellen looked at me and said,
"Do you really think your mom's gonna call the cops? 'Cause technically I am breaking my parole. I'm not supposed to cross state lines without my parole officer's permission."
"I don't know," I said. We all three turned to look at Mom, who came across the front lawn toward us, glowering. But now might be a good time to leave. Where should we have him take the bike? Wavy gestured to the tow truck driver.
To hell with that, sweetheart, Kellen said. Get on, and let's ride this thing.
Give me your keys, and I'll have him take your car home, I said. Practically glowing, Wavy handed me the keys. She hugged me so fast and hard, I didn't even manage to hug her back. Then she hiked her skirt up and got on the back of the bike. Laying her cheek against Kellen's shoulder, she wrapped her arms as far around him as they would go. He gunned the bike and they rode away, leaving Mom, me, and a confused tow truck driver standing in the street.
I want that pickup truck towed, Mom said.
20. Kellen. December 1990. We were quiet for most of the drive, with Wavy staring out the window. But when we saw the first sign for Tulsa, her shoulders tensed up. We don't have to do this, I said. For the first time in almost 2 hours, Wavy looked at me. Glared at me. Times like that, I was glad she didn't talk much, because that hot look would have come with a mean mouth. I just thought maybe you'd changed your mind.
I didn't.
She went back to looking out the window. I sure hadn't changed my mind. I didn't want to do it when she first suggested it, and I still didn't. The closer we got, the more nervous I got. I love you, I said. I couldn't always get a free pass with that, but she laid her hand on my leg. I put my hand on top of hers and wiggled the diamond under my thumb. A few miles later, she leaned over and rested her cheek on my arm. Her stomach growled. Did you eat anything? These days, she could actually sit down and eat at the table, but last night, she couldn't get any dinner down. No breakfast either that I saw.
Too nervous, she said,
but she still wanted to do it. The harder a thing was, the more likely she'd be able to do it. I couldn't hardly believe what she'd done to get me back. With her holding my hand, I could have gone on driving forever. But then there was the exit. A couple more turns, a minute waiting at the last stoplight, and we were there in less than 3 blocks. After I parked at the curb, I took the flask of bourbon out of the glove compartment and drained it. Liquid courage, I said. I expected Wavy to frown at me, but she leaned over and kissed my cheek. Then she reached into the back seat and shook Donald awake. He sat up and rubbed his eyes, still half asleep and surly. I felt for the kid. He wanted to be there about as much as I did. Following Wavy up the sidewalk with the flowers in my right hand and the bottle of wine in my left, I felt like an asshole making her go first. She rang the bell and stood in front of me like a shield. Donald stood behind us like he wasn't even involved. He was still working out how he fit in. When the door swung open, it was somebody I didn't know. A young guy with a ponytail and a pink polo shirt. He didn't know us either, but he let us in. Merry Christmas! I'm Bryce Standish. I'm Leslie's husband, he said.
Who is it, Bryce?
Leslie came into the hallway and stared. I hadn't seen her since she was a teenager, but grown up, she was narrower in the face, more like Val than Brenda. Hey, Leslie, I said. Then Amy walked in and said,
You came.
She headed straight to me and I thought she was just going to take the wine, but after she had it out of my hand, she put her arms around me. Surprised the hell out of me. I knew Amy didn't hate my guts the way Brenda did, but I hadn't figured any of the newlings would be happy to see me. Wavy had her fingers hooked into my belt loop and she didn't let go when Amy added her to the hug, so it was the three of us holding on to each other, which was weird, but good. That's how we were when the storm door opened behind us. Where my hand was on Amy's back, I knew the second she saw Donald. She shivered and took a step back from me and Wavy. Then one of her hands came up over her mouth.
Donald, she said. It's so good to see you. Donald.
That was Leslie, and she looked like she was going to cry. Amy tried to hug him, but he was all bristly teenager, crossing his arms over his chest and ducking his head. He wouldn't even say hello. Is everything okay, Leslie? Bryce said. It's fine. These are my cousins, Wavy and Donald Quinn, and this is,
Jesse Joe Kellen, I said.
Still smiling, Bryce stuck his hand out to me. I shifted the flowers and we shook. Not Barfoot? Leslie said.
Nope, the judge changed it. It's Kellen. Now, Bryce, you better step back, I said as I let go of his hand. Why is that? You don't want to be standing too close to me when your mother-in-law realizes I'm here. Maybe she'll just call the cops, but there's a good chance she'll try to kill me. Either way, you don't want to get caught in the crossfire. Like always, my nerves kept me talking. Bryce laughed like it was a good joke, but Leslie gave me a nervous smile.
The flowers are gorgeous. Let's put them in the dining room in the good crystal vases, she said.
Vases. Turned out they were a fancy glass and too small for the flowers, so I used my pocket knife to cut down the stems. It's like Hell's Angels floral arrangements, Bryce said, staring at the tattoos on my arms while I messed with the flowers. A mistake, wearing a t-shirt, except that Wavy liked to see her name running down the inside of my forearm in 3-inch letters. I wasn't ever in a gang. I pretty much managed to get into trouble all on my own, I said.
Who was at the door?
Brenda Newling walked into the dining room, drying her hands on her apron. Behind her was a tall, red-headed woman I didn't know. Right when I needed it, the bourbon kicked in. Hey, Brenda, it being Christmas and all, will you at least give me a head start before you call the cops?
21. Amy. He actually called my mother Brenda. I waited for Armageddon while Mom gaped at her prodigal niece and the much maligned and long-reviled Jesse Joe Kellen. A flush crept up his cheeks as he folded his knife and put it in his pocket. We were all holding our breaths, expecting a scene. But then Mom saw Donald. I sympathized with the shock in her face. At 14, he was taller than Wavy and even thinner. Everything about him was defensive. His shoulders hunched inside a gray hooded sweatshirt and his hands jammed in the pockets. He may have been Sean's son, but he looked so much like Liam I felt like I'd been punched in the stomach. I can only imagine what Wavy felt when she looked at him, like seeing a hybrid of someone you love and someone you hate. In the awkward silence, I could see Mom trying to feel a bunch of things at once. Anger, annoyance, relief. And then, when she looked at Donald, love and guilt. However he'd been brought back to us, we were all at fault for how he was lost. Mom came around the table and tried to hug him, but he backpedaled, scowling. I think he might have escaped out the front door, except that Kellen laid a hand on his shoulder and kept him there.
You're just in time. Dinner's ready, Tricia said.
She stood there looking beautiful and welcoming. I was so glad I'd invited her. I'll put more place settings out, Leslie said. She added 3 more places to the table while Tricia and I got kitchen chairs to make up enough seats at the dining room table. Then we started carrying in the food. When I brought out the ham, Tricia was shaking Kellen's hand.
Hey, Tricia. Good to meet you, he said.
I'm Amy's roommate, she said.
My roommate?
Hearing that stopped me cold, because I remembered that drunken night in high school when Wavy had tried to comfort me. Nothing left to be afraid of, she'd said. Even if that wasn't true, I wanted to live like it was. I wished that I had introduced Tricia properly to Mom and Leslie, but all I could do was correct the mistake. Actually, I said, Tricia is my girlfriend. Tricia's mouth dropped open for a second, and Leslie snapped her head around to look at me. Like a reward for my bravery, Wavy reached out and shook Tricia's hand. In an act of diplomatic caution, Leslie put as much distance as she could between Kellen and Mom, but the result was that they sat at opposite ends of the table, facing each other. Still, it probably wasn't much worse than most family holiday dinners. Mom was torn between glaring at Kellen and smiling tearily at Donald, who sat next to him. The rest of us tried to keep the conversation going with as much harmless chatter as we could muster. We talked a lot about the weather, and Leslie and Bryce's honeymoon to Mazatlan,
Wavy seemed different, but I couldn't tell why. She managed to eat half a dinner roll and a bite of ham that took her almost 5 minutes to chew and swallow. Kellen ate slowly and methodically, clearing his plate, while Donald picked at his food.
"How are you, Donald?"
Mom asked over dessert. She'd asked that a couple of different ways during dinner, but all she got were mumbled responses.
"Where did you find him?"
Leslie said, like it was a scavenger hunt. I tried,
"How did you find each other?"
Because that was the question nagging at all of us. After 7 years, how had Donald come to be sitting at our table for Christmas dinner?
"My parole officer knows this private detective," Kellen said. "Got him to look through juvenile records in a couple states. He found Donald out in California."
"What about Sean? Where is he?"
Mom looked at Wavy when she said it, even though the answer was likely going to come from Kellen. At the mention of Sean, Donald stood up from the table, sending his fork and his napkin tumbling onto the floor. He shoved his chair back and stomped out into the entry. A moment later, the front door slammed. Kellen picked up the fork and napkin while Wavy whispered something to him. He and Mom stood up at the same time. He followed Donald out the door while she headed toward the front windows. Part of me wanted to give them some privacy, but it wasn't the strongest part. I peeked out the edge of the curtain. Donald and Kellen stood on the front walk, just about where Wavy and Kellen had been reunited earlier in the year. Donald was hunkered down against the cold while Kellen leaned over him, talking. Donald nodded. Kellen took out his wallet and handed Donald some money. Then he pulled something out of his front pocket and palmed it to Donald, while giving him a rough pat on his shoulder. As Kellen came back up the sidewalk to the house, Donald got into their car, started it, and drove away. I tensed, waiting for the inevitable explosion. As soon as Kellen stepped into the dining room, my mother said,
"What are you thinking? He's not old enough to drive."
"Yeah. Well, he's not old enough for a lot of the shit he's been through," Kellen said.
"You cannot be serious. You cannot be serious," Mom said, even though he obviously was. "And what if he gets pulled over? What then?"
"He won't get pulled over. He's a decent driver. And dollars to donuts, he's just gonna go up the road to the gas station and buy a pop or something."
"We have some pop here," Leslie said.
"He don't need anything to drink. He needs to get some fresh air."
"He is only 14, Mom said.
Kellen clenched his jaw, and I could see that under all his jokes about my mother's anger, he was carrying a grudge. I imagine 6 years in prison will do that.
"What do you want from the kid? What the hell do you want? You think this is easy for him? Coming back here after all these years and seeing his family and not knowing what to say or how to act? It's fucking hard, okay? It's hard for him."
That shut Mom up for a few minutes. Kellen dropped back into his chair with a thud. He snapped his napkin across his lap and picked up his fork. We were all quiet while he chewed an enormous bite of pie.
"So is Donald living with you?"
I said. Wavy nodded.
"Since November," Kellen said.
It looked to me like it wasn't easy for him, either.
"What happened? I mean, with his uncle, your uncle, Sean?"
The whole conversation was a minefield.
"He's dead," Wavy said. Kellen looked at her and she shrugged. "He died of a heroin overdose more than 2 years ago. Donald went into foster care after that and then ended up in juvie."
"Juvie?"
Leslie said.
"Like jail?"
Kellen sighed and set his fork down.
"Yeah, he had some trouble on a breaking and entering charge. Nothing serious, the kind of shit kids get into at that age. We hired a lawyer to get us through family court. Good guy. Did okay by us. You know, I had to have my parole transferred down here, and then I can't live with anybody under 16 because of the sex offender thing. But the lawyer got us an exception for Donald, since he's my brother-in-law."
"Wow,"
I said. It was like getting important news from a telegram. Sean dead, Donald in jail, Kellen and Wavy married, stop.
"That's great that he could come live with you," Tricia said.
She and Bryce were both trying not to look stunned by their crash course in Wavy's life.
"Yeah, it's really great,"
Leslie jumped in late, but she made up for the delay by nodding vigorously.
So how is he?
He's doing better, but like I said,